Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast that's got more downloads than Trump got attending his Tulsa rally. My name's Corey Hazelhurst, and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hi, Corey.
Also joining us from New York is our good friend Patrick. Hello, Patrick.
Hello, guys. Happy Saturday. Happy end of another crazy week in American politics.
In British politics, anyway, it's been a bad week for my movers and shakers picks, because one of my picks was, at the start of the year, was Rebecca Long Bailey, who's been dismissed from the Labour front bench, shall we say. And another pick was Leo Varadkar, who is now no longer the Irish Taoiseach. It's not looking... If I was Priti Patel right now, I'd be seriously worried. Although, as Patrick hints, it's been another crazy week in American politics. It is now 128 days until a presidential election. How's that looking? Joe Biden, I think he's been ahead in almost every poll by about 10, 15 points. Donald Trump's approval rating seems to be sliding. Why is that, Patrick? Is it because of Trump's handling of COVID? Is it mainly that? Are there other factors at play? What do you think is going on here?
I think definitely COVID probably plays into it. I also think probably is protests related to police reform and stuff like this kind of energized the base that probably wasn't super energized to vote for Biden. But I think also that the COVID related to the fact belief of Republicans are pushing the economy open up is more important than people's lives. And I think that there's viewpoints of just like, he just doesn't care. It's about him. He hasn't really, if you watch that Tulsa rally, I only watched part of it, or seen any of the what should have been softball interviews on Fox News that he's done, there really isn't any message other than comforting his base but not expending one. I couldn't tell you what he's running on, what his re-election message is, because I don't think anybody actually knows, other than I'm Donald Trump and you need to adore me because I want to be president isn't a re-election one. I also think that, and I never thought that I'd get to the point where that something would have sticked for Donald Trump, but I think this Tulsa rally, the kind of responding, usually some of these things have maybe last 17 and a half seconds in the media landscape, but it seems to be that some of these things that Trump has done are starting to hang around longer than they usually do, which is a concern. Now, another concern related to it is that now that the polls are showing Biden at such a high number, you want to hope that the media doesn't seem to, you know, when Trump goes up 2 points in the national polls or something like that, they then now don't talk about how he's an underdog, because that's kind of what happened in 2016, is that he led as an underdog and that's how the media carried him. Really, COVID, the increasing feeling that the economic response is not equal to the average person. I think people are starting to come to realization that they're not better off than they were 4 years ago, and pinning the problems on Trump in the White House on top of, I would also say probably some of these other things that have come out related to the John Bolton book, the Barr stuff, the two losses in the Supreme Court in 1 week over administrative law, basically. It's starting to kind of show people that probably weren't heavy on Biden would have maybe not voted or voted third party in these states, to see that there just isn't a functioning federal government under Trump, and that might have tilted a solid amount of voters away from or caring about voting for Donald Trump instead of not voting or just voting third party. That's probably a simple answer to a much longer question of lots of tiny things that Trump has done over time are finally adding up.
On that, I think Patrick's kind of hit the nail on the head when he talks about the kind of the lack of a message from Trump, and that so much of what Trump's campaign at the moment seems to be is just vote for another 4 years of me as president, with no real indication as to what that actually means or what he's going to try and do. I stumbled across an interview this morning by Frank Luntz, who's I don't know if he still works for the GOP, but he certainly was a GOP strategist at one point. Basically says that Trump has just managed to completely get the wrong tone with so many, much of his response to Black Lives Matter and the coronavirus situation. So for instance, Luntz talks about how Trump is talking law and order, where he's making statements about how he's dispatching thousands and thousands of heavily armed soldiers to help deal with protests and riots and things like that, when, according to Luntz, he should be talking about public safety. So he's just using the wrong kind of languages, using the wrong kind of messaging, which is just turning people off and off and off. As Patrick says, there probably is a wider kind of, all of these little things over the past 4 years have just added up. And now we're just starting to see, you know, the pile of them get so big. And because we're getting closer to the election, people are paying more attention to these things now. It's all starting to come home to roost a little bit for Trump. If I was playing around with 270 to win website. Now, based on the current polling, Trump basically needs to win every single swing state that's classed as a toss-up currently to be able to get to the 270 figure that he needs to win. And currently, of those swing states, which are a toss-up, these polls are taken from 538's polling database, and I think they're pretty much all A and A plus, kind of like pollsters. So these are the good ones. So in Wisconsin, Biden up 11. Is up 11 on average. In Pennsylvania, Biden up 10. In February, that was plus 3 for Trump. In North Carolina, Biden, average of plus 5. Florida, a must-win state for Trump. If Trump doesn't win Florida, he basically has no path to actually getting to 270. Biden's average, plus 6. Arizona, plus 6 average for Biden. Overall, Biden is basically leading in states worth 368 electoral votes, which is far more than the 270 he needs to actually win, which puts Trump in a very, very bad position. From a battleground perspective, Trump is very much on the back foot. And as Patrick said, I think we're seeing an awful lot of the failures of the Trump administration actually finally kind of come home to roost.
We'll talk about why the polls are wrong and Trump's going to win eventually in a second. In terms of the lack of an agenda for a second term, it's something that Dave Weigel picked up in his trailer newsletter back in May. There's things like repealing the Affordable Care Act and getting rid of healthcare for more Americans, which I'm sure is an issue which will play great in this election. There were plans for a big tax cut that Trump was trailing that would happen in 2021. But again, I think plans of the economy have sort of kiboshed that. And then there's familiar things that he played with 4 years ago, like trying to finish off building the wall or appointing more conservative justice to the Supreme Court. But they're just not cutting through because of that message discipline. And as Patrick alluded to, that incoherent interview with Sean Hannity, where Sean Hannity just gives Trump a very easy sort of nice half volley question. Sorry, Patrick, that's a cricket reference. But a nice easy sort of, you know, what do you expect your priority to be in a second term? And there's just a big word soup from Trump, which is about how he now has experience and has met people in Washington and doesn't address anything at all. So I think there's just a real big issue for message discipline of Trump, where he's just not able to say clearly what he wants to do. But even in 2016, there was at least, you know, a bit of a build the wall, you know, make America great again, make Mexico pay for it. There were messages that were repeated and cut through, and that just isn't happening this time. The contrast that Weigel makes with Bush and Obama is so they had quite thought out policies that were set out in their State of the Union addresses in the election year that would form the basis of a second term agenda. Now, in Trump didn't really do that. His main things in the State of the Union back in January were a mission to Mars, which admittedly I didn't realize George Bush and Obama also mentioned, but, you know, it's maybe not a bread and butter issue to lots of Americans. And the other thing was Jared Kushner's plan for Middle East peace. So it doesn't feel like there's been a lot of intellectual heavyweight work going on there either.
No, and I think when you look at the kind of like the Trump campaign at the moment, there seems to be a bit of panic happening in the GOP about the Trump campaign, in that it's basically being run by, I think the guy's name is Brad Parscale, who basically is a digital campaigner for the most part, but he's been put in charge of the entirety of Trump's campaign. There's a lot of discussion as to whether or not he should maintain his position, whether or not he should be removed. Whilst yes, there hasn't been a lot of kind of like the intellectual heavy lifting that you're talking about there, it's also just that the person who's running the campaign itself isn't doing a good job, which in turn is resulting in nobody actually kind of like saying to Trump, these are the four things you need to hammer home, or however many points it might be, because they haven't worked out what that is yet.
But I wonder if that's because the plan, I'm guessing, for Trump was to say, look, the economy's booming and the stock market's booming, that's all my doing, vote for me for another 4 years and it'll be fine and we'll carry on this message. And to be fair, as you said, from those state polls, like a lot of those state polls looked very, very good for Trump, even just a month or two ago. As Patrick said, like it's not just the sheer mismanagement of coronavirus, which has been an issue, but it's the economic impact of it and the lack of an administration's response to it as well. What Trump was going to run as re-election, that plank is gone. Instead, you haven't really got very much. And so instead, Patrick, what he seems to be doing is holding rallies and sort of toning up the racist rhetoric and talking about Kung Flu, which is just appallingly terrible.
Back to your point about the Middle East pen from Jared Kushner, it's got a real feeling of he's got a real feeling of Sir Cyril Radcliffe with the partition of India feeling with that thing. Also, to the point of Brad Parscale, so I read an interesting article related to that. It was basically saying that Jared Kushner is basically running Trump's re-election, and that was a pick by Kushner for Brad Parscale to run it. So the theory goes that Brad Kushner wants to leave because he doesn't think it's unattainable, but it also might be this thing of like them completely just taking this re-election from Kushner and putting it to someone else. But also the insane amount of money that they get paid is ridiculous. Brad Parscale's getting paid like $47,000 a month to be the campaign manager or something along that crazy. Like, I think I've heard this, especially in British politics, that you always fight the last election. 2019 Labour is a really good example of that, trying to recreate what happened in 2017, 2019. But I think also that with Trump in particular, he thinks that having these rallies, one, getting his ones, the example of banning foreign visa, basically no foreign visa holders for the next 6 months, because in his words, and in their quotations, the coronavirus needs us to do that. There definitely has been a ramp up of what he thinks his base wants to see to try to change the narrative to it. But the thing that it seems like he's doing, and it doesn't really super make sense, he's only basically thinking that his base is going to leave him, that he needs to keep his base strong and as strong as his base is following. It's not. But I just don't see how you're going to get moderate R's and moderate Republicans and independents in swing states if you're that don't maybe see immigration or certain other things or tax cuts for the rich is important to them. The narrative seems to be on the wrong points of pressure for him, because there's been a couple of layups that he could have taken advantage. He could have looked at the economic recovery and, you know, showed him how supply side economics could help them, but it doesn't include tax breaks and large bailouts to companies. That's kind of one of the problems that basically caused a shift for the Democrats to a much more liberal position based on the TARP bailout. There just seems to be misses on what he's trying to do. Rallies help keep your base one. It's like putting lawn signs up. It helps keep your base happy and that feels strong, but it doesn't bring voters in by any means. There was I think it was in the New York Times poll. I could be wrong. They trust Trump on economic messages and more than they trust Biden, but that is not enough for people to say they would vote for him for president. And the other social issues and all this kind of stuff is kind of what is dragging him down more than anything. But if you're going to try to tell Trump to not do what he wants, it's going to be hard. He just wants to be loved and a very narcissistic. I don't know also if there's anything he could do that's going to turn the tide in a couple of in pivotal states based on all of the opposition research he's already given to the Democrats in the Lincoln Project.
The Lincoln Project I've seen coming across my timeline on Twitter a fair bit over the past week or so, and they have been running some really interesting attack ads, including on Fox News, right around about the times when we know that Donald Trump watches Fox News, which is an interesting kind of form of political trolling. They've had some very, very slick adverts. The one that I saw, I think it was yesterday, was basically attacking Trump for being unpresidential, comparing his response to Black Lives Matter protests and I think kind of COVID to a degree as well, to how Reagan responded to the Challenger disaster, how Clinton responded to the Oklahoma City bombing, and how Bush responded to 9/11. You know, lots of uplifting statements, lots of meaningful speeches, and then you have Trump literally saying, "I'm dispatching thousands and thousands of heavily armed soldiers to the streets of the United States," and it's just so good. It's just so effective. It's being done in a way which is going, I think, has a lot of potential to resonate with an awful lot of independents who do, as if I'm understanding things right, normally kind of lean a bit more Republican, but hitting Trump where he's got a lot of, there's a lot of weakness to him.
Yeah, it's really interesting how a town in the East Midlands with a really nice cathedral seems to be really up on US politics. I find that quite surprising.
Oh, Corey.
The other one that's been good, that's the thing that I think Biden kind of actually needed, was is that the money was never going to be exactly in the favor of Biden in terms of the air war and one. And it will be very interesting to see in this election, have we passed peak influence of TV ads? And is it more going to be put on ads on social media or stuff like that? It will be very interesting to see what the impact some of these ones. But the other thing that I think that Lincoln Project, the Republican Voters Against Trump, is another one, a group that's similar to that, is, much as I love my wonderful party of the Democrats, we tend to sometimes be in an echo chamber with what we think people are going to want to see against Trump. So it's kind of helpful to see people that are Republican voters, people that were, you know, that are registered Republican or Republican conservative leaning, put out messages against Trump from a slightly different viewpoint that they know will hit, that might be not seen by a Democratic strategist or media team.
On that, my mini prediction is that actually one of the most meaningful bits of social media nonsense, which is coming out of lockdown, which might have an influence on the race, are a lot of the, Sarah Cooper who lip syncs to Trump's comments?
Yes.
There was an interview that she did with The Guardian, and there was a really interesting remark, which was a Democrat supporting people sharing it to their like Republican relatives or friends or what have you. And they said, well, actually, there's nothing, it's really hard to attack back and criticize because it's actually Trump's words, you know, it's not being manipulated. Like, on that, I think, Patrick, one of the things, Labour's got this as well, but like Labour and the Democrats and left-wing parties, I think, often have a reputation of being quite po-faced and being quite humorless. And so actually being able to use wit is a bit of an undervalued quality, whereas actually I think we tend to go, or a lot of left-wing parties go straight for the outrage, and so seeing people on the centre-right as well using maybe different type of values, like using Ronald Reagan to have a go at Trump, is, yeah, it reaches a different part of that coalition, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I think it was a poll a couple of weeks ago, it was definitely mentioned on 538's podcast, but they were saying that the ads that do the best in terms of focus grouping and what they do poll are ones that are literally just Trump talking. They're not slick with all these graphics, but like just Trump just saying what he's just recording of what Trump has said. And then maybe at the end, you know, do you want this or something like that? They said the more simple ads of just things that Trump has said seem to be more impactful than these slicks. He did this and he did this and da, 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 you know, Trump's not fit for president. I'm Joe Biden and I approve this message. Ones. They were saying that like the more simple ones of just kind of showing Trump being Trump seem to be more one. And I'm a big believer that outrage works on certain things, but overwhelmingly you're just waiting for your opponents to then just call you a snowflake, you know, and all the people to come to the ones that you're just outraged about everything. Why aren't you outraged about this?
Your point about how like the left tends to run towards, you know, outrage on things, I think is very valid. And I do think as a whole, we tend to ignore the role that wit and undermining things in a less angry way, I suppose, is the best way to put it, can have. Like the first thing that popped into my mind as soon as you said that was one of the biggest pieces of damage that was done to Gordon Brown was, and I think this was after he bailed on the election that never was, was when Vince Cable in the House of Commons said he'd gone from Stalin to Mr. Bean. Suddenly, like, one little quip turned him into a laughing stock. No amount of kind of like getting angry about it would have shifted people's opinions in the same way as that one piece of wit.
No, and on that, actually, as well as the Vince Cable comment, there was a David Cameron quip at PMQs. Don't know if you remember David Cameron. He's the one who destroyed this country. I think it was after Gordon Brown had called off that election, did an interview with Andrew Marr saying he hadn't called it off because the polls were looking bad. And then Cameron made a quip to the effect of he's the only prime minister to not call an election because he thought he was going to win it. Unlike Trump, we have to vigorously practice message discipline. Let's get on to the second thing we were going to talk about in the podcast. So that's Joe Biden. So Trump doesn't have a positive agenda for himself now. Instead, what he seems to be doing, we're either trying to make comments that Joe Biden is essentially a mad old man with dementia. Don't know if there's any projection in that. And the other thing is that he's trying to tie Biden to the extreme left, in whether that's the extreme left like AOC in the Democratic Party, whether that's the Black Lives Matter protesters. I'm reading at the moment, Rick Perlstein's done some excellent books on America in the 60s and 70s. Just on the bit where Richard Nixon is quite effectively linking the Democratic Party to a lot of the more extreme protests at colleges against the Vietnam War. What do we think of A, are Trump's attempts to attack Biden this way, are they going to work? And B, what have we thought about Joe Biden's campaigning so far?
So this is the same concept we were kind of talking about earlier, which is that he's trying to run the 2016 challenger kind of campaign plan when you are the president with a record. The idea is that he basically is trying to say about how the Hillary Clinton attack points worked really well because he ended up getting elected in 2016. But if you saw from the Tulsa rally, the Biden same points, similar points that they made to Hillary Clinton that worked really well for Trump in 2016 aren't hitting the same way. There's not this 15 years of Republican media ingraining of how bad Clinton was for Biden. Biden technically is kind of a person that kind of goes off message when he feels like he's always been like that. He did it like, you know, the one time where he said it's a big effing deal during a press conference with Obama. Like, that's kind of Joe Biden is kind of a little bit off the cuff. Him being kind of limited to Zoom calls and stuff, and with scripts and stuff that he can look back, they can pause for him to finish, you know, take his moments, is probably pretty good, because Biden has more, will always have more to lose just because of the double standard that exists in American politics of for example, this accidental mistake of saying 120 million Americans have lost a life of coronavirus, and then he immediately corrected himself to 120,000, and then that has basically been all over Twitter on the Republican ones for that kind of stuff. Now Trump makes mistakes like that on a regular basis, but nobody seems to care. I think Biden is portraying himself as in a much more positive one, but I think Biden's has able to do with something that probably was going to be a problem for him, is he's the current protests and stuff. One, he's able to kind of reset the narrative, and he's going to be able to have penance for past sins related to the crime bills in 1994, various things where he maybe wasn't the best on criminal justice reform or wasn't the best on race relations issues. This is able to kind of take a problem that probably would have been used by the Trump campaign related to things he did in the 90s, that he's able to kind of reset the narrative that, yes, he's made mistakes, but he's with them now, is probably very helpful for Biden to what would have been a very good attack at if there wasn't a coronavirus and there wasn't race relation protests. That his message, his positive message, is becoming a lot, is definitely stronger than I would have thought. What he says on Twitter is pretty in touch with other people. There's a positive message coming out of the Biden campaign. Is it as specific enough on certain policies that maybe it should be? No, probably not. But also, I don't think someone wins by having this incredibly 125-page document of every policy you're going to do. You can ask the Lib Dems how that works. You know, you have to kind of have these general themes and work off of them. People want to know your ideas in 10-second quips. And I think that, you know, there is a point to have policies, but there's also a point just to be in touch with what the electorate is feeling at that moment. And I think that the Biden campaign is doing really well with that.
A lot of hatred for the Lib Dems in this podcast. Do apologize.
I realize that.
Typical Labour bastards, aren't we? I know we're talking about Donald Trump, but we know who the real enemy is.
Sorry, Mark Pack.
And hello. Let's then talk about why all the polls are wrong and Donald Trump's inevitably going to win. Now, it's not necessarily that the polls are wrong. I don't talk about politics much with my in-laws, but one of the things that they will reliably say is that you can't trust the polls and will then always cite Donald Trump's win as a result for that. Whenever this happens, I always tediously explain that actually Hillary Clinton won by 3 points in 2016, and the polls also said that she'd win by 3 points in 2016. It's actually the fact that it's the how the margins of the Electoral College. You all know this, and my in-laws no longer invite me to family get-togethers, so that's how well that's gone. My pessimistic counterpoint then to a lot of the Trump is going to be defeated by Biden, especially in a landslide, is that it's unsurprising at this stage that you have a challenger who is doing quite well at this point. But I think Donald Trump's got quite a good advantage in the Electoral College anyway. I mean, I know you've talked about this a little bit, Steve, but it's perfectly possible that, okay, if it's the polls at the moment say that Trump is losing by 10 or 15 points, it's probably almost impossible to lose by that many nationwide and carve out an Electoral College win. But if it was to narrow to 8 points, I think there definitely is a path to victory, because then you are probably do scrape through in some of these states like Georgia, Arizona, North Carolina, Ohio. Then you can probably pick up ones like Florida, which probably just about get you over the edge, I think, to 270. So the other thing, as I keep banging on about, is I worry about how easy it will be for people to vote in these key states as well as the race starts to tighten, which I think, as Patrick sort of hinted, I think it will once the kind of both sidesness of the American media kicks in. And if especially if Biden does say something a bit daft that is then leapt upon to almost prove so the networks can prove their objective. I think it's I don't see this being a blowout one way or the other. I can see it being very narrow.
I would fully expect things to narrow. Obviously, like, things could continue more in Biden's favor for a little bit, and maybe in theory he ends up on an average of, I don't know, plus 12, plus 13, and then it drops back down to something more realistic. Or, you know, maybe this is the peak and it drops back down to, as you say, plus 5, plus 6 or whatever. But I think the thing to point out is, compared to Clinton was basically led the national polls by about 4 points at around this kind of time during the election cycle, and on election day itself she led by about 3.8 points, which is just a singular regular polling error. That's within margin of error. Biden is currently twice that at plus 9, so the likelihood that you have such a swing against him, as well as kind of like some kind of like polling situations kind of pushing kind of like Trump up, is quite slim. And the one thing I would say is that those state polls that I quoted earlier, they're terrible for Trump in comparison to what they were like in 2016 as well. One of the main things that 538 kept on kind of hammering home in 2016, and why they kept on giving, you know, Trump a 33% chance or whatever it ended up being in the end, versus like a load of others which were basically saying, oh, there's like a less than 5% chance or a 1% chance that Trump wins. Look at the state polls. Now, even Matthew Goodwin, the esteemed right-wing kind of like academic on Twitter, has put out a load of kind of like tweets relatively recently on this, basically saying, hey, look at the 2020 race through the same lens as 2016 in terms of what did the pollsters or commentators or whatever get wrong, and then account for it. It's still not looking good for Trump. Like, Goodwin himself cites that the states are not those particular states, so Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Florida, Arizona, as we alluded to earlier, potentially Georgia and things like that. Those could all be going heavily against him, and do look like they are at the moment. So I get where you're coming from, Corey. And you're absolutely right. Things are going to narrow. A week is a very long time in politics. And when you've got somebody with a history of being as gaffe-ridden as Biden is, you know what? Something could absolutely turn around and this could all do a complete 180. So yeah, it's not, I don't think it will be a blowout, although there is a chance that it could be. But the path for Trump's victory is very slim currently. And this is the thing, polls are snapshots, not predictions. Currently, the path is very, very slim. It's going to take an awful lot to widen it.
The one thing at 538 also, building off Steve's point, is that they also were hammering in the point that it only really needs to change four to five points nationally for him to for it to turn in Trump's favor. It doesn't, because of the narrowness in some of these swing states, that really 5 to 6 points change in nationally could put him in a slim but winnable position into a winnable position with the Electoral College. The other thing that I think is more important and had been discussed by Nick Cohn and by Harry Enten and a bunch of very good pollsters on Twitter, or poll watchers and data guys, were saying that you got to look at the breakdown of the demographics in a lot of these state polls that are going to tell you more truthful stuff, that probably maybe the numbers change. It will change, but look at where there are in terms of demographics. For an example, is that in Hillary Clinton in Wisconsin, for example, was basically underwater when it came to non-educated white voters, which are predominantly a big portion of the electorate in Wisconsin. And it's basically one of the reasons why Trump ran that state. If you look at Biden's numbers are considerably better than Hillary Clinton's in that state, along with Hispanic voters, with Black voters. If you look at these ones, even with the 9 points, there is just very, very interesting changes in the demographics and who they're supporting, different than they were in 2016 for Hillary Clinton. So the trick to be watching these ones, is especially the state polls, is look at the demographics and its changes versus Hillary Clinton's position at the same place in 2016, because Biden's numbers across these demographics are groups are better in most places than Hillary Clinton was, that Trump won on in 2016. Non-educated voters being the biggest one that the numbers are better, or Hispanic voters is another one. The numbers among educated white voters, which a change of 5 to 10% in favor of Biden is probably would be good in a lot of these smaller states that took a chance on Trump in 2016, may not want to do the same thing in 2020. So those are, like, I'd look at the demographics breakdown to see it's different things since 2016.
And in fact, if you want to read a book about polls and understand how they work and the ins and outs of them, read Mark Pack's Bad News. If you have £47,000 going spare and you didn't want to spend it on Donald Trump's campaign manager, or even if you've got a bit less than £47,000 spare cash a month, you could support us, Steve, couldn't you, on our Patreon page?
You could indeed. You could head over to patreon.com/notenoughchampagne and you could become a supporter of the podcast over there. Throw us a few quid every month and it will get you access to unique content that we record specifically for our supporters, early access to content, as well as access to some kind of like live chats and discussions that we run periodically as well.
Yeah, there's an episode that's just gone out on the government's handling of Brexit in particular and the risks of a no deal. And we're going to have Shaz Rahman, who regular guest, he's agreed to do a Patreon call on environmental issues next Saturday. So Patreons look out, or Champagners, I believe we're calling them now, look out for that on our Patreon page. Thanks so much, Patrick. We'll talk to you again very, very soon, I'm sure. In the meantime, our website is notenoughchampagne.com. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. Our Twitter handle is @nochampagnepod. James Cram designed our logo. You can follow him on Twitter @JamesCram. And Dave Depper composed our theme tune, Fucking Good Times. My Twitter handle is @paperbackwriter.
Mine's @acousticradical.
Mine is @pcook11.
Happy plotting.